Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. Sitting across from me, as usual, is Mike Costantino.
Good morning.
And we have with us today, again, Professor Paul Lenz. He's a professor of international affairs and politics up at the Northern Arizona University. He's an expert on military-civilian relations in the Middle East, the relations in the government. Today, we're talking to him again about Iran. And I think that one of the things people don't understand is the difference between Iran, which is a Persian country, and the Arab world that's just to the west of it.
Yeah, most Americans just see it as one. Arab is Arab is Arab, but it's not, and that has consequences.
Yes, it does, and this is a centuries-old conflict that goes back to the death of the Prophet Muhammad. And it divided the Muslim world between Sunni and Shia, and about who was the rightful descendant of the Prophet Muhammad.
I see.
And so in Iran, the Shia in Iran believe that Ali is a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad, and any descendant is the rightful ruler of the people.
I see.
And so this created a huge division within Islam. Ali was eventually killed, and his followers grew up around him, and subsequent to his death, they became known as Shiites, or followers of Ali.
So sometimes the animosity between Shiites and Sunnis is at the same level it was in the West, say, hundreds of years ago during the religious wars between Protestants and Catholics. I mean, there's a really sometimes there is and sometimes not. Is there areas where they get along, Paul? Or
well, there have been times in history where they have gotten along, but it's a period in you're talking about a span of thousands of years where this conflict has gone on. So modern politics, though, in the region, and this ethnic tension that's underneath, both ethnic and sectarian, is a direct result of what happened after World War I.
Well, give us your characterization of modern Iran now.
Okay. Modern Iran today is a society that's made up of predominantly Persian. It's the dominant ethnic group. There are other minorities within the country, but they all share Shia Islam as their faith, and they speak Persian. And Iran today is a country that is modern. It has a burgeoning middle class. The largest part of its population is actually between the ages of 18 and 35.
That's right.
And this large youth population and middle class and middle age population has actually created a lot of problems for the clerical regime in the Islamic Republic as the economy has continued to falter. There's not been enough jobs for many of these young people, and caused a lot of protests throughout the years, beginning even in the 1950s.
If you're an Islamic conservative, you want to have economic development, right? Because that'll help support your regime. If you have no economic development, won't that cause unrest in Iran?
It'll cause economic unrest anywhere in the Middle East. Just like us here in the West. The people of Iran, as well as many Arabs, they want shelter. They want to be able to feed their families. They want to be able to send them to school, be able to find a job after they get out of school, and live a normal life. And what happens is politics has gotten in the way of that, as you have different groups vying for power and international actors trying to influence what happens in these various countries, and especially in Iran, because you have the influence of the Cold War and then subsequently the War on Terror post 9/11.
I was very much impressed by younger Iranians' protests back a couple of years ago.
Right,
extremely brave, brave, courageous people in standing up to the regime and protesting. What's driving this Islamic regime? We were talking another time about why do they keep poking Israel in the eye when it looks like they don't have to.
Right. Well, the main reason that Iran is essentially trying to exert its influence in the Middle East is because it wants to be a hegemon, what we call a regional power, you know, to control and influence politics within the region. You know, and this stems back in the beginning in 1979, 1980, after the Islamic Republic came into power, is that you had the Iran-Iraq War, where Iran and Iraq fought for 8 years. And trying to battle it out for supremacy. And you had the international community, specifically the United States, assisting Saddam Hussein.
Right.
And this assistance actually put Iran opposed to U.S. policies. It caused the Ayatollah Khomeini to call the United States the Great Satan and directly state that Israel was the sworn enemy of the state of Iran. And so policy since then was Iran trying to influence the United States' involvement within the Middle East, specifically by providing funds to Syria, providing funds to Hezbollah in Lebanon, to the PLO in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and later on Hamas in the West Bank.
There's a good deal of ideology and prestige involved in this for Iran.
What is the Iranian government? I mean, the people are, many of the people are very upset with it. Other people support it. What does it want? What are its major goals? Is its major goal is not probably world domination because the population and small, that can't be an ambition, right?
Iran is a very nationalistic country. And so the clerical regime today under Khamenei is concerned about three things. Concerned about prestige, security, and to use nuclear energy and this development of nuclear energy to appeal to Iranian nationalism. To say that, look, we are helping the Iranian economy. We are doing what's necessary to make Iran a powerful country again in the Middle East that Arab states will have to deal with as well as international actors will have to deal with specifically just within the Middle East. It does not have global ambitions, as you were saying.
When I was thinking about it, why they wanted this, they want to protect their country, right?
Right.
And a lot of their aid to other Shiites is kind of, it, probably from their point of view, feels like a responsibility. I mean, the Shiites in Lebanon were in a very, very difficult position for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, from their point of view, they have a justification for doing that stuff that's beyond the politics of it? Or is it mainly driven by power politics, do you think?
I think it's a combination of desire to help your fellow Shia, but it's also been ratcheted up because of power politics and the influence of the international community in picking sides in the region, in the conflict in Lebanon, in supporting Saudi Arabia, in the United States supporting Saudi Arabia.
So everywhere in the Middle East, the big powers, I mean, Saudi Arabia and the United States are supporting one side. In Lebanon, for example, and Iran is supporting another group.
Right. Iran is supporting the Shia within Iraq, you know, post-2003 and after the U.S. invasion.
So I think everybody can understand when you have all these outside powers coming in with money and guns and whatever it is, then you fracture things much worse than they would be if the country was left on its own.
Exactly.
I want to make sure we have time to get to solutions.
We've got 30 minutes, Mike, so go ahead and let's talk about, because we're
worried. You know how these
worried.
Academics are. But seriously, the comedian Dave Barry said that after the Middle East blows itself into smithereens, those microscopic particles, as they hurtle into space, will be fighting each other. The Middle East is convoluted, it's complex. We've just outlined in this show on the last ones part of that complexity.
For example, in Syria, a lot of the minorities are supporting this very repressive Assad government, right?
I mean,
the Christians are supporting it largely. Druze are supporting it. The Shia are supporting a government. And they're very much terrified that Sunni extremists Al-Qaeda-like people will take over Syria. On the one hand, you have this nasty Syrian regime, and on the other hand, you have the worry from a lot of the religious minorities of what might happen.
Okay, what was the question about?
Well, essentially, you have the same kind of complexity all over the Middle East. You have all these different groups kind of in conflict with each other. How do we move what can the United States do to move to peace, or encourage peace between countries? Do we take sides in Syria, or do we step back, or what should the United States do?
Well, the United States is, it's important for the United States to remain involved in the region, because we are essentially the largest superpower, and we have to maintain a free access of oil to the global oil market. You know, that's one of our main national interests. You know, and we've chosen to promote democracy beginning in 2003 with the Bush administration, but then even in the Obama administration, you know, we've gone to Libya with the international community to overthrow Gaddafi. But the situation in Syria is a vexing one for the international community. And I say that because you have China and Russia who do not want to see the United States get involved into further domestic politics of one of their allies. And so just a few weeks ago, they vetoed a resolution at the Security Council that would have allowed for an international force to go into Syria.
And they don't seem to care what the Syrian government is like, right? As long as it's an ally of theirs, they're going to side with it.
Right, and that's generally been the nature of post-9/11 politics, but even in Cold War politics, the United States and Soviet Union would choose to side with various leaders depending on the nature of the politics within that country and what that country was going to do for their ultimate national interests of the United States or the Soviet Union.
Let me try this. We had another Middle East expert on the show. And I want to talk about in the next few minutes the failures of maybe even the successes of American foreign policy and how they relate to Iran and across the Arab world, the other Arab world.
Right.
But she says that one of the reasons for the Fatan Goshen said that one of the reasons for the success of Arab Spring was that Obama didn't get in the way. For the first time, American foreign policy didn't get in the way. We didn't support the dictator. We didn't support that entity that somebody figured out furthered American interests. We just stayed the hell out of the way. Is that right?
No, I would agree.
Where was that coming from?
Well, I think what happens is you had a coalescing of factors in the region at that point. You know, 2003 through up till 2011, you know, in the Arab Spring and the winter of 2011, you have the United States going through its involvement in nation building in Iraq, and we, the international community, as well as the Arab world, they saw what was happening. You know, you have the development of Facebook, the development of YouTube and Twitter.
Right. Uh-huh.
You know, social media became a way for civil society, you know, young people, middle class workers in the region to be able to protest. So it wasn't necessarily always out in the street, but they organized Facebook groups. They posted what these Arab dictators were doing mm-hmm. in the region to be able to show the world what was happening and to show their fellow Muslims, fellow Arabs, and even Persians in Iran were protesting too, showing them what was happening. And what this led to was an opening in the West, so if we got to see what was happening. And so the American president, President Obama at the time, during the Arab Spring,
right.
the writing was on the wall for these Egyptian, you know, the Egyptian regime and a number of the other monarchies that you can't continue to repress your people like this.
But to jump back, this always wasn't, you know, the part of the reaction in Iran has been to failed American foreign policy, or at least mistaken American foreign policy. And what was that?
Are you beginning in the 19? You were talking about the 2009 protests, or prior to that?
Prior to that.
Well,
we can start with 2009 and work your way back.
No, I'll go back.
Well, for example, we talked to Noam Chomsky, and Noam Chomsky says whether you're talking about Arab Spring or anywhere else, the United States always defends the regime that's in power, that's furthering its economic interest, whether it's a really dictator or whatever, or a semi-dictator. Some of these democracies out there, folks, are not much really in the way of democracies. And then when the dictator begins to fail and look weak, we dump him. And then we side with the people, and then we side with the military to take back over, so we don't get too ferocious a populist movement going, which might be angry about our support of the dictator. It's a sort of a terrible circle.
No, it is, and it's a terrible circle that was begun, as I said earlier, post World War I, where our interests were ensuring stability. We wanted to ensure the status quo. And so we were going to side with whichever regime was going to ensure that the status quo could be maintained. And for many years during the Cold War, that was nefarious dictators. It was monarchs. But now, in this new globalized world that we live in, these protests are beginning to happen because you've had 60 years of young people not having an opportunity to have a voice in government.
So Facebook and Twitter are larger forces for democracy than the Marines?
They are one aspect of influencing democracy in the region. The Marines are a way that the United States can try and bring stability to a region. As you guys are well aware, 2003, that was a war of choice to
right.
take out Saddam
Absolutely.
Hussein. So what that did was it unleashed the tension and the status quo that had been established during the Cold War. It unleashed the ethnic tension between Sunni and Shia and ignited Iran's influence to continue to influence politics in Lebanon and in Syria and in Israel with supporting Hezbollah and Hamas, respectively. And so that brings the United States even further,
right.
as we have to try and challenge what Iran is doing.
Let me frame this question. Let's back up. We got Israel, we got the United States, we got Iran, we got the possibility of a third recent Middle East war. What's the solution? How do we avoid that?
Well, it's a good question. The way that we should avoid it is we continue to talk with Israel and persuade them, as I think is what Obama did in his meeting with Netanyahu last week, is that we try to continue the regime of sanctions. Now, we want to continue to promote the sanctions against Iran because they've actually been working. They've hit the Revolutionary Guard, which is the elite military force of Iran. They've hit them pretty hard, but they've also hit the international market. Specifically, Iran cannot no longer sell oil to the international market, and the states in Europe, as well as the United States, have cut off trading with Iran. And so this has begun to hurt the Iranian, not just the Iranian government, but it's beginning to be felt in Iranian society.
So what is the effect of that on the opposition movement? Does the opposition movement, the liberals, the Democrats, progressives, whatever you want to call them in Iran, what's the effect of sanctions on them, and what are their chances of overthrowing or changing, even over time, this regime that seems to hold all the cards in its hand?
I think the ability for them to actually change the regime is going to be very slim. And the reason I say that is because the conservatives within Iranian society have such a stranglehold since 2001 on politics within the region. Not just the region, but specifically within the country of Iran. And by doing this, they've established their men in the bureaucracy of the country to help run the various institutions. And the Iranian Revolutionary Guard has a tremendous influence in politics in Iran, because the Revolutionary Guard is actually set up or was set up to protect the Islamic Republic and the office of the Grand Ayatollah.
In a lot of places in the world, folks, the army actually owns factories and stuff. This is true of China. It's true of Iran. They own factories. They own industrial shipping things. They own oil production facilities. And so they're really ingrained. So if you were the Iranian opposition, you wanted to see change, you wanted to protect your country, what would you do as a young person if you were in Iran?
Well, if you're seeing what happened in the Arab Spring, I think what you'll see is continued efforts to use social media to try and influence politics in the region. But you're also going to have, I think, international influence as well in trying to influence the democracy movement within the country. But I still think it'll be very hard for young people to actually have a say in Iran because of the use of the security services, the use of the military to prevent dissent.
Even though the majority of people in Iran are young, right?
Right, yes, they are. I just think that right now there's too much of a stranglehold on these institutions of power that there's no way for these young people to actually get into politics.
So I'm a young Iranian scientist, and I see older scientists being mysteriously assassinated.
Sure.
What's going to be my reaction to an attack? I hate the government, say. I think the government is just as oppressive as we think over here. What's going to be my reaction if Israel, the United States, attacks Iran and attacks their nuclear? Are they going to rally around this Iranian regime, or are they going to what?
They're going to do exactly that. They're going to rally around the Iranian regime. An attack against Iran would be a way for this regime that is fracturing. There are splits within the conservatives versus the reformists, but an attack would only serve to legitimize the Iranian government's desire to get to finish its nuclear energy cycle and move into nuclear weapons production.
Well, that's it. Let's take it one step further. There are peace movements. If I was a lily-livered liberal, I would say, if we remove the threat in Afghanistan, if we remove the threat in Iraq, take out every American troop, downplay American influence, where there is no more American threat. There's no more troops, boots on the ground that a militant can point to and say, this is why you need to fight for Hamas. This is why you need to strap a bomb to your body. And this is why we need to not bow to the sanctions. And we need to keep saying we need this nuclear capability in Iran.
Yes, you're exactly right. We need to, as the United States, remove the motivation for Iran to want to acquire nuclear weapons.
But you can imagine what the right wing in this country would do with that. They would see that as, well, I can write the copy now, turn tail and run. I mean, would be the nicest thing they would say about that.
Right. But, they would be saying that essentially it's going against, our ally Israel. And we don't want to be seen in the West as being anti-Israel.
And you're suggesting that less is more, that looking less threatening to countries over there actually would have a benefit rather than it would actually increase. Is that what you're suggesting? Might actually increase our influence rather than decrease it?
Exactly.
And I think it goes about using, that has been called in the past smart sanctions. You continue the sanctions if Iran continues to move full speed ahead in secret in producing this energy capability. But if it remains a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, then it still has to open itself up for inspections. And if it does that, then the United States can maybe reduce some of the sanctions and engage Iran in the politics of the region so as not to be seen as overly meddling.
So, in other words, a method for diplomacy to actually work.
Right, exactly.
Because the Iranians went from supporting basically American intervention in Afghanistan because of the persecution of Shia by the Taliban, murdering Shia people all over Iran, all over Afghanistan. Originally, they sided with the intervention, but once we started invading Iraq, you were telling us that attitude changed, even among conservatives that had been trying to play, a power game there.
Right. It's because you had the United States had boots on the ground, as you were saying, in Iraq, on its west, and in the east, in Afghanistan. So it essentially felt surrounded. And so it wanted to use this development of the nuclear energy, not only to promote modernization within society, but the thinking goes that they eventually want to develop a nuclear weapons capability to use it as a deterrent against further United States intervention in Middle Eastern affairs.
And outside of the United States, they're not without, with good reason. You know, I think Americans, we don't see ourselves as a warrior society. However, our history kind of begs to differ. And so if you look at it through an Al Jazeera, I'm talking about media, the one of the most popular media outlet in the Middle East, and quite frankly, in a lot of Europe, Al Jazeera English is extremely big in Europe. We are a belligerent power that likes to use its, we are a warrior race. We think of a military force first.
Well, and I think a lot of that has to do with what various U.S. presidents have thought was in our national interest. And throughout the history of the Middle East, it's been about protecting our access to a free supply of oil, you know, that will allow for modernization both in Western Europe, in Asia, in the United States, and keeping this globalization process rolling, you know.
There's a solution, folks, or something they call the Japan solution. Japan has all the elements to build a nuclear weapon gathered, but they don't actually go to assembling of a nuclear weapon. In other words, they have the parts that it could be assembled. Called the Japan solution. Would that be a compromise with Iran, or is that too much and too dangerous a solution?
Actually, I don't think you can use that analogy in the case of Iran. And the reason I say that is because if you remember, back in 1945, we helped to write Japanese constitution. We help them develop their democracy, but we also put them under our nuclear umbrella. You know, so Japan, we've said that we will protect Japan if they were ever attacked in a nuclear attack. And so that's why they've, although they've modernized and they've developed and have nuclear energy for peaceful purposes, they'll never develop a nuclear weapon because they've signed a military agreement with the United States that we will protect them.
Would the Soviet Union be willing to do that with Iran?
I think that's a possibility. But
so there is no Soviet Union. I apologize.
Yeah, I know what
Russia.
You mean.
Okay,
Russia,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, you shows you're a little dated. Refer to the Soviets and Soviet Union. It's Russia.
Got it.
Right. I think that's a possibility, but I think that Iran is a very proud people, a very nationalistic people, and I think the reason that they're going to continue with the nuclear fuel cycle and the potential development of this weapon is that they want to be seen as defending themselves and not have to rely on international interference. And they view even a protection from an international actor like a Russia as interference in their security and their domestic politics.
I think we really do have to think out of the box. So it's an interesting suggestion to have Russia or China guarantee their security. We've got a couple of minutes. Mike, you got another question for Professor?
Just to review the solutions, I think we might have got lost in our, what can we do?
I think what we, the United States, can do is continue working at the sanctions. You know, continue
sanctions
to try
trouble.
And, yeah, first you want to pressure the sanctions. You want to tell Israel, you know, not to attack. You know, they're going to trust the United States.
So if I'm a right-wing hawk and I'm in the United States and I'm saying sanctions don't work, tell me a time when sanctions worked.
Tell you a time when sanctions worked? They're working right now.
All right.
And they've worked since the 2000s, even under the Bush administration. Although
they worked in Libya, right? Libya traded.
They turned
trying
in
trying to do nuclear weapons for a release of a lot of resources and ending of a boycott of their products.
Yeah, well, Gaddafi was developing a capability, and what ended up happening was after the Bush administration overthrew Hussein, Gaddafi negotiated with the Bush administration to give up his nuclear capability.
We're going to have to end it there. We have a lot of content in these shows, as we often in this show, as we have in our other shows. You can hear them on bvid.org. The podcasts are there for this show and others. It takes a good day or two, but they will be there. Please check it out. There's lots and lots of good content there.
Okay, folks, check in with us next week
for
we'll
more
be
exciting
back
statistics.
For half an hour. We appreciate you folks listening, and we know we're dealing with, as Mike said, complicated subjects, but we got to do this because we can't act out of just catchphrases and stuff. You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.